the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 112, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode called UFO Encounters, so please check them out. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, please join the Patreon campaign. There are now more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Christopher Knoll about his book, UAPs and the Afterlife, how new disclosures support centuries of psychic and spiritual research. Christopher holds a master's degree in philosophy from Yale University and a master's in fine arts from Vermont College of Fine Arts, where he taught writing for 20 years. He also researches the phenomenon of Sasquatch. He's the author of many books, including Mind Speak, Tapping into Sasquatch and Science, and There Is No Veil, At Play in the Vast Here and Now. Hi, Chris. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome, Simon. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called UAPs and the Afterlife, How New Disclosures Support Centuries of Psychic and Spiritual Research. What you say at the beginning is that you could have just as well titled it UAPs and Consciousness. So how does that fit in with saying psychic and spiritual research or consciousness?
Well, to me, consciousness is the whole ballgame. So there are as many different definitions of it as there are researchers of consciousness. There are not that many definitions, but many, many. And so it's become a kind of a catch-all term, whereas the afterlife is a little bit more specific. And the afterlife is consciousness. So they're synonymous in a sense at one level. So I thought that rather than title it UAPs and consciousness, which would be a little bit more nebulous, I'd give it a more of a pointedness, and then people can find out in reading the book just what I mean by the afterlife and how I think researching into the afterlife and into the survival of human personality after bodily death relates to our visitors from somewhere on these strange craft that we see all the time.
UAPs and psychic and spiritual research seem so far apart, but it's not that thing where they're just alien biological beings like us in spaceships. There's something a lot stranger going on.
Yeah, according to Jacques Vallée, it's much stranger in all of its array of associated phenomena and can be explained by a simple recourse to thinking of them traveling from literal planets to our world and landing and just being nuts and bolts technology and biological creatures. Because for one thing, we look at most of the descriptions of these visitors, they're very humanoid, human-like. And, you know, they're upright walking figures with two legs and two arms and fingers and toes and a mouth and a nose, just where our mouth and nose are, and two big eyes and a head. And there's distinct differences from our morphology, but there's also a great deal of overlap. And it's not plausible to me that such a species would evolve independently on a foreign planet. I think that they, from all I can tell, not just from the morphology like that, but also from hundreds of accounts of people's interactions with them, that they are deeply akin to us, even genetically. You know, there's reports that some DNA analysis was done of the Roswell crash figures, the dead ones that they found, and that they had DNA that bore a striking resemblance to our DNA. I think that means that there must be some common root between our species and the various species that seem to be represented by these visitors. So that's one thing. I don't think it's just as simple as aliens in the true sense of the word coming to our sphere I think it's something about us in contact with ourselves, and whether it's Michael Masters' theory that there are future humans coming back to monitor us or to help us to avoid some disastrous outcome, or whether it's some other relationship, like potentially it's the deep past that had something to do with shaping our trajectory through evolution. You know, many people think that our DNA has been tampered with or perhaps upgraded over the eons to separate us from the other primates and allow us to achieve such technological advances in a relatively short amount of time since, you know, 12,000 years ago when we started growing wheat. You know, now we're visiting Mars with little robots, and it hasn't been that long. So some people feel that it's more plausible that we've been assisted in our evolutionary progress than that it was just a, you know, survival of the fittest and, you know, just a strict Darwinian explanation for that. But anyway, your question is, why is it not just nuts and bolts? And it's because people's interactions with these visitors are clustered with paranormal experiences that overlap to a great extent with what people experience in poltergeist cases and in spiritual visitations and in psychokinesis, objects moving, objects seeming to ignore gravity, becoming lighter than air, which happens in seances and happens in UFO encounters alike. Also, telepathy is a parapsychological area of study and has been amply, indubitably demonstrated over the years in experiments. And this happens, people report telepathic communication with the visitors too. And there's a phenomenon in seances called aports, where objects will suddenly appear out of thin air, drop onto the table or drop onto people's laps. And UFOs too appear out of thin air. The list just goes on and on of the affinities between the sorts of phenomena that accompany UFO encounters and encounters with the occupants and pilots of the UFOs and what people experience in psychic and spiritual peak experiences, like in seances and sometimes encounters with spirits that aren't mediated through seances.
That's one of the things you talked about earlier was about how these ETs that are reported can be so similar to us, be humanoid with the arms and the legs and the head. And another thing about that is that they seem so comfortable in our atmosphere and in our gravity, and that this doesn't seem like they are catching any illnesses. There's probably all sorts of bacteria and viruses around that might kill them quite quickly if their immune system wasn't used to them.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's why they need their ships, you know, to replicate the atmosphere that's ideal for them, because wherever they're from, another frequency level within our own space or some other location, they're probably not used to the exact conditions that we have here on Earth. I mean, many people report that the small grays, for instance, the most numerous of the reported descriptions, they seem to float, or when they walk awkwardly. They don't bend their knees the same way. They don't seem to have the same relationship to gravity that we do. So I think that their natural state is less dense than the earth plane, just like spirits. And that when they visit, they become denser so that we can suddenly see them. Like they'll appear out of nowhere. The ships will appear out of nowhere, and so will the humanoid creatures sometimes appear out of nowhere. And then when they abduct people, as I believe they do, the people suddenly become weightless, float through the air, and describe themselves as feeling like they're becoming more rarefied, less dense, and the abductees will say that they actually went through the wall or through the ceiling of their house when they were taken, and that doesn't happen if you're of normal density. So I think there's a great deal of manipulation or modulation of density. That, for me, as you know from the book, is one of my main guiding concepts. Is this the principle of density, and how it can vary a great deal.
So there's that thing of, like, they talk about crash discs and recovered bodies, and this is all very physical. But then there's this other side to it that you talk about, where it's like the, I'm not sure the right word, like multidimensional, or they're phased slightly out of our reality. So it's almost like a contradiction that you would have the physical craft would crash, but then it doesn't phase back into its own reality.
I think that it can just kind of get stuck. I'm holding in my hand right now a little stone that I was given in a seance last summer that came out of thin air. And yet it stays here as a stone. I can pick it up anytime. I think it's similar with the crashed UFOs. I don't know why they crash. You know, people, it's very, very common for people to sort of laughingly say, oh, they travel from 100 light years away and then they can't manage to fly in our sky without crashing. And they may not come from far away, and there might be reasons behind the crashes. It seems that the folks who pilot these crafts are somewhat like drones, not the full embodiment of the ultimate agency behind this whole phenomenon. They seem to be biological robots, kind of worker bees or soldiers, and they may be expendable. There's a sense that they're not very individualistic, that they're collective, a hive mind. And it has seemed plausible to me that these crashes or landings that are then recovered by us are orchestrated as sort of a boost to our developing consciousness of what's possible and what reality is like, so that we get these craft and we try to reverse engineer them, and we find out that ordinary technology outside of the psychic and spiritual realm doesn't work, and that these vehicles need to have a consciousness interface in order to operate, that teaches our human race that our materialistic worldview is too narrow. Maybe something along those lines, that the reasons for the handing over through apparent crashes or landings, the handing over of their technology to us. It could be like a teaching tool, a mentorship that takes a concrete form in these instances.
Yeah, because it's weird that if these flying saucers have crashed, that the other ETs or aliens, whoever they are, don't send down like an ambulance or a recovery crew?
Yeah, a rescue crew, you would think so. But no, they just seem to be left to their own devices, and the reports are rampant through the history of ufology that some of the occupants of the craft are dead and some are still alive, and they get taken into custody and interviewed. But they don't talk. You have to bring a psychically gifted human being in for the interview to communicate with them mentally. And there have apparently been many of these interviews. Recently, you may have seen this man named John Stewart, not the comedian, but a former politician from the United States, and he has done lots of detective work on this alien interview video, that was apparently shot in 1996. And anyone listening here who's interested in pursuing this can find out many, many details that won't come to my mind right now. But it's fascinating that there's a long interview with John Stewart on the Cosmic Rogue YouTube station channel. And he shows clips from this interview video, and it looks just like the gray aliens that we hear from thousands, tens of thousands of contactees and abductees. And it's one that was recovered supposedly from a crash, and it's in very bad shape, and you can see it in distress. And apparently the story goes that it died shortly after this interview. And it's extremely strange looking. And from all that we can tell, nobody did it to make money as a hoax. It was just something that seems to have leaked from the military intelligence. And it's very poor quality, but you can see the little figure. Anyway, the whole history of UFO research is full of these stories the fact that no, nobody does come down to rescue these crash victims. They're just kind of left to languish in our world and either survive for a little while or die on impact or survive for longer. And, you know, then you have stories of agreements that have been struck between the human race and these visitors. And that's so mind-boggling. It's hard to conceive of it, but it may be the case also. You know, I'm very much a newcomer to this field. My background is in studying psychic and spiritual phenomena and in studying the species known as Sasquatch or Bigfoot or the wild man. In Britain, you call him the wild man. Anyhow, so my contribution to this field, I hope, is just that I can see having researched the long history of spiritual experimentation and research and learning that took place during the spiritualist movement from 1849 all the way to the mid 1900s, there's just so many similarities between the phenomena that occur in mediumship, especially physical mediumship, and what people report, and the huge effort that's been undertaken by scientists to understand the propulsion system and the anti-gravity properties has all been done within a very materialistic framework. And I think that's why it seems they haven't made much progress, because they can't understand how you could be able to defy gravity without an apparent propulsion system, without wings. You know, these craft come in all kinds of funny, very non-aerodynamic shapes, and yet they seem to have no trouble going from 0 to 1,200 miles an hour instantly and making right turns that would, under normal circumstances, would just turn pilots into jelly because of the G-forces involved. But they just go on their merry way. They can go from 80,000 feet down to 50 feet in less than 2 seconds, as was the case with the Tic Tac object that was tracked on radar, in addition to seen by the pilots off the west coast of the United States. So these maneuverability properties and performance profiles are just baffling to scientists who are working within sort of strict materialism. But I think that if psychokinesis within a spiritual setting can allow a table to levitate, and I have I refer to videos of such things in my book and link the reader to them, then it's not much of a step to think that they could levitate larger objects without any materialistic technology needed. It's not really technology at all. It's just the fact that consciousness can affect the physical world and can cause objects to to move through space as if there were no gravity. You know, when people say that they see these little gray visitors floating in the air and passing through walls, nobody wonders what the propulsion system is for these little critters. They simply are floating. So if you extrapolate from that, it doesn't seem to me that you need to try to imagine or invent some sort of conventional or even leading edge propulsion system in order to also defy gravity. You're just barking up the wrong tree. You're barking up the tree of materialism. And it's much wider, reality is a much wider, a set of phenomena than can be boiled down to materialism. So that's what I think I am trying to contribute to the conversation, because it seems that all the learning and demonstrations and evidence that has been gained over the last 176 years since seances really took off has been forgotten. The understandings that have been gained and that are very clearly documented in hundreds of books over the century and three quarters is being neglected, or people are oblivious to it. So in my book, I try to bring all this rich resource to bear upon the discussion or the enigma of these UAP visitors in the long history of our people interacting with their people.
So when I talk to mediums, when I'm interviewing for my other podcast, I so often say that the people that have died and they're into the afterlife, that place, the afterlife, isn't way off somewhere in the sky, that it's right here, exactly where we are, in the same kind of space, but they're shifted out of our reality in some way. And did you kind of feel that the UFOs, the aliens, the UAPs are also kind of phase shifted out of our reality in the same way?
I think they're nearby just like that. Yes, Simon, I've heard that's a convergent view. People saying that it's not some far off heaven, that heaven is right here in front of our nose, and it's, you know, 1,000 miles up in the sky. That's the other thing that I'm glad you reminded me of, is that this whole notion of distance is an illusion. The discovery of the phenomenon of quantum entanglement shows that you can have two particles in two parts of the universe, and they can still behave as two aspects of the same object, which shows us that space, as we think we know it, is not the way underlying reality is, and that even if these visitors do live sometimes on a faraway planet, they don't have to travel the intervening light years to get here. They can just show up through, in the same way that an aport can show up inside of a seance room. They can materialize into our density from a much, much thinner, lower density. And in the book, I suggest that this lower density substance that is what consciousness is made of may be also what we call dark matter, because nobody knows what dark matter is. And its characteristics, so far as we can infer them, are that it's very, very low density, and that it's ubiquitous. It suffuses our entire galaxy and every galaxy in the entire cosmos. And yet it's not the same kind of matter as ordinary matter that we know of. It's some other sort of matter. And consciousness, too, is some other sort of energy slash matter. Because matter and energy are really two sides of the same coin. And we know that consciousness is like this because the mechanism behind telepathy, behind remote viewing, behind psychokinesis, and other parapsychological feats or accomplishments, the mechanism has never even remotely been captured by the instruments that we have. So it can't be any part of the ordinary material world. You know, people have been seeing ghosts and experiencing telepathy and seeing reality from thousands of miles away, or seeing something that's happening in the next room when they aren't, you know, when all the doors are shut, all sorts of things like that for thousands and thousands of years. And that's why the entire realm of supernatural beings, the supernatural agency, God, was invented to explain this unseen force, this unseen intelligence that seems to be occasionally coming through into our reality from a larger reality frame out there. And yet, scientifically, we have never laid a finger on it. We have no idea what it is. Similarly, we have no idea what this dark matter, I call it invisible matter, because it's not really dark, it's just invisible. There's what this is. And I know that just because one thing is mysterious and another thing is mysterious doesn't mean that they necessarily have any relationship to each other, anything to do with each other. But all of the descriptions by people who are in spirit about how they're existing in an environment that is very fine, very rarefied, and that they need to force themselves down and down and down into density, back into earthly density, in order to come back into contact with us. That aligns itself with the sort of substance that this invisible matter, dark matter, must be. So it's a proposal. It's just a theory of mine that that this invisible matter is suffusing this room that I sit in, and that room you sit in, and all the listeners. There's dark matter all around you. In fact, there's at least as much mass of dark matter, not more, than there is mass of ordinary matter. And yet the dark matter is super lightweight, super high frequency. That's the other thing. It's high frequency because it's there's not really a good word for undense except rarefied. If you can think of it, tell me. But it's so rarefied, and yet the mass from calculations of astrophysics, the mass of it is greater than the mass of ordinary matter, as we can tell its gravitational effects on galaxies, that it must just be abundant in the room around us. So what's it doing? We have strange things that we can't account for, all sorts of strange things we can't explain within the framework of ordinary matter. So why not turn provisionally or hypothetically to this invisible matter to see whether it can help us? And for instance, in the case of levitation, people have tried and failed for centuries and centuries to explain how things can suddenly float in the air. People sometimes levitate. There's books I could refer you to about that. They're very, very rigorously researched. Saints have floated, especially Saint Joseph of Cupertino. Saint Teresa, she levitated. But how is this possible? You know, it's not electromagnetic in cause. People, tables that have been lifted have been tested for electromagnetic changes, and there are none. So it's nothing that we know about. I think it's my theory on that is that the invisible matter, the super undense invisible matter that that suffuses all the space that we know here on Earth will increase its ratio within an object until that object becomes lighter than air. And so it's a flotation, it's a buoyancy. Just like a helium balloon will float through air, a table or a chair or a lamp or a pencil can be caused to float, to become lighter than air by conscious intent. It's either a conscious spirit or a conscious, still living human being, a medium, can make these things levitate. And I think that the medium or the spirit is orchestrating this invisible matter. I think the invisible matter is consciousness, is the matter produced by consciousness. Because if consciousness were not some form of matter / energy, wouldn't be able to have an effect on the physical world because it would be nothing. I think it has to be some form of matter, which some people who are dualists say is wrong. They think there's matter and then there's this not matter stuff. But I think that I like to look at materialism as one kind of materialism with a small m, which is the traditional materialism, and another kind, capital M materialism, that embraces the entire swath of matter, including the invisible matter that so far we've only known about for a few decades, and we haven't been able to detect with our instruments, because these instruments are calibrated to ordinary matter. We don't know how to capture or measure this this enigmatic matter that's around us. So that's a mouthful, I know. I don't know where you want to go with that.
Well, there was something I saw in the book that I wanted to ask you about. It's to do with orbs and UAPs. And you say they're like two peas in a pod. But first of all, how would you define what an orb is?
Well, orbs are very common, both in spiritual psychic context and in UAP context. People see orbs all the time, by themselves, in groups, in association with larger spacecraft that are appearing or descending. And so orbs are spheres of energy. They're very efficient shape. They're a sort of a natural shape that matter and energy can take. You know, like raindrops form into spheres and bubbles form into spheres. There's sort of the lowest energy form, because everything is uniform from the center. It's hard to describe, and I have it in the book, but I can't remember. I'm sorry, but it's a natural and energy efficient way to manifest energy and matter. So orbs are seen all over the world, flying super fast. And sometimes caught on camera, and they are associated with spiritual visitations, spirit visitations too. I think they're consciousness. I think there's some manifestation of consciousness. Whether this is consciousness associated with the visitors from another frequency level, or associated with departed human beings, spirit, their consciousness. From another vibrational level.
And you say in the book, there's no reason to think that the occupants from these craft inhabit our afterlife. So do you feel like they could be in some way completely separate?
I don't think they're completely separate. I think that they're vibrational neighbors. A lot of people will be abducted and they'll see dead relatives in association with the visitors. I think there's a kinship between them. I don't think they're one and the same thing, because if the occupants of these UAPs had the ability to go to quote unquote heaven, however you want to define that, the higher higher vibrational, more enlightened state of being, why would they continue to boomerang back and forth between are between the surface of the earth and wherever they disappear to. It seems that they're stuck in between, and they're looking for something from us. I think that's why they take us aboard and they extract our genetic material. And apparently, according to many, that they are conducting a hybridization program with the human race. I think in order to either return to an earlier version of themselves, that we are that earlier version, and they're from the future and have lost touch with the more the root of their being, and they come back to us, and they're trying to take that from us.
The ETs won't be in the afterlife, so they're separated from the afterlife in a way, because you never go to a medium and the medium says, oh yeah, Uncle George is coming through, he said he saw some aliens the other day in the afterlife.
Yeah, that's right. I think they cross paths. Our spirits and the aliens cross paths sort of in the midway, in between this density level and the ultimate density level, which is our destination in the afterlife. I think that perhaps these sort of soldiers, little biological robot soldiers, are looking for a way. An outlandish theory I have is that they don't have souls because they're more like cyborgs, and they somehow know that we do have souls and that we will transcend into a higher state of being that they can't reach. And so that's why they're sort of bouncing back and forth between where living people are and where we go. And when they take us aboard their ship, they don't take us to the afterlife, do they? They don't take us even to the blender that folks report when they have near-death experiences, their out-of-body experiences. No, the aliens take us instead to some sort of nondescript metallic chamber, like a tank or a hangar or an operating theater. It's very, very different from the glory that people describe in the afterlife. So I really do think that they're in some sort of purgatory. I mean, to put a Catholic terminology label onto it, and that they need something from us. I think they're, when they probe our body and take individuals and family members over and over and over from childhood all the way through old age and generation after generation, I think they're poking and prodding, trying to find that essential spark that we have that they lack. You know, that's my sort of half-assed guess about it. You know, nobody knows, you know, or if they know, they're not telling. So the rest of us have to just kind of grope in the dark for an explanation. But at the end of my book, I quote Whitley Strieber, whom I admire greatly. And he talked about how these visitors, their form of existence usually is outside of the, quote, time stream. And folks who have near-death experiences will also say, I was outside of time. There's no linear time anymore when you're in this next phase. And I think that Whitley Strieber resonates with that when he says that he thinks these visitors are very machine-like, very insect-like. They're kind of cold and calculating and will just do what they want to do without concern for our welfare, it seems, you know, because they're kidnapping us and, you know, doing horrible things to our bodies. So they're just very matter of fact. And so Whitley says that it must be like being dead and being alive at the same time. They have no time. There's no linear time. So they can't experience life the way we do. And he thinks that there's some effort to vicariously enter our sort of more suspenseful, more educational, a kind of a story that we get to live that they don't get to live, both because they're not individuals like we are, and because they're outside of time and they're just kind of in this limbo. And so that's he thinks, why they continue to intrude or penetrate into our time stream so that they can, for a little while anyway, they never stay long, do they? They can feel what it's like to be alive, and they grab us to get closer to that sensation of existing in time. And they poke into our bodies to try to find what it is that makes us so lucky.
Some people would probably say, I don't feel that lucky being incarnated in a life on Earth.
I know, we don't. But apparently once we, you know, people who die temporarily, it's not near death, they're actually dead. But then they are, that's reversed through medical heroism. People who die for a while say that they already start to realize what the purpose of their all their suffering and their laborious effort and all that seems to be so just kind of difficult and you know, dense and sucky about the world. They realize the purpose of it and they what they learned from it. But you can only see it from in retrospect. We don't have the ability to embrace the value of being alive all the time when we're alive, or very rarely do we. And so, you know, it's that we're in a schoolhouse down here in a theater piece that allows us to evolve, to learn. And somebody said that a life existing, not coming down to Earth and experiencing this travail and this beauty and all in between is like going into a gym that has no weights. You know, it's like lifting weights morally and intellectually for us here, so that we can evolve and advance as moral beings. I mean, that's what you hear kind of consistently from those who've come back and from the other side who speak through mediums and speak sometimes in midair. Have you ever heard of Leslie Flint?
Yes, he was a physical medium, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he's British. I thought maybe you would have. And he, for 60 years, get this, held seances in which voices spoke from the air. And he had thousands over the years, thousands of folks who would wait for months and months to get a seat, you know, in his room. And it would happen in pitch dark, but it was voices of people who had died, and a new visitor would recognize, that's my mother, that's her voice. And the mother would tell personal things that the visitor, the guest in the room would know, or certain things that the guest didn't know and later found out was true, so that there's no chance that Leslie Flint was reading the mind of the visitor, like information that was unavailable to either the medium or the guest, and only verified later. All sorts of things like that happened, and he had a sort of a sidekick in the spirit world called Mickey, who was a boy who had been killed in a car accident when he was, I think, 10 or 11, and he was the sort of poor jester who would come and sort of get the energies of the room elevated and the vibrations elevated, so that it was easier for the manifesting spirit voices to come, you know, come through. And people investigated Leslie Flint. They did all sorts of things. They put tape over his mouth, water in his mouth, and then like duct tape over his mouth. They thought maybe he was throwing some sort of voice from his throat, but not through his mouth. So they put microphones strapped around his throat and found that there was no such thing. But nevertheless, these voices came clear as day from midair in all different parts of the room. And this happened for 60 years. And people don't realize, I mean, how are you going to explain that in a materialistic way? If anyone's interested in him, you can read his biography, his autobiography called Voices in the Dark. And also, there's a YouTube channel called the Leslie Flint Trust that features, I think, around 200 recordings of these sessions. That's the beautiful thing about this. From he did it from 1930 to 1992. And from the 50s, they began recording. They got their hands on, you know, consumer level tape recorders at that point, and they began recording these sessions, and hundreds of them exist. So you can hear them on YouTube. There's also a website, the Leslie Flint Trust website, that you can go to. And you know, when you hear things like that and many, many other angles of evidence, you just, your skepticism and your doubt and your resistance just gets worn down. There is definitely an afterlife, and it's uniformly described as consisting of a much, much higher vibration of consciousness. I mean, it's not really different from the consciousness that you and I have right today, because our consciousness is not confined to our little brains. The mere fact that we can be in touch with our departed loved ones shows that we can attain the same high vibration that they exist at, or we sort of meet in the middle. So the fact that we're conscious right now shows that we're really spiritual beings, the same as we will be in the afterlife. There's a famous old saying that goes, we are as much spirit now as ever we shall be.
There's a thing with alien abduction, isn't there, where people report that it seems like the aliens abducted their consciousness and left their physical body behind?
That sometimes happens too. Yeah. There's a subset of alien abductions where people look down and see their body on the bed and they say, oh God, I'm being taken. You know, some of them will have experienced out of body travel before, and some of them won't have. Most of them won't have. Suddenly their consciousness is being abducted. Yeah, definitely. That's not as much represented, I don't think, in the John Mack material. That's what I'm mostly familiar with. It's his two groundbreaking books from the 1990s, Abduction and Passport to the Cosmos. But that definitely does happen. And some think that they're just simply harvesting human souls, like I was mentioning before, that there's nothing more, high-minded or transcendent to it. It's just sort of a brutal harvesting of human souls, because they don't have souls and we do. I don't know if that's the case. I hope not. If that's the case, you know, you wonder, well, why isn't this being disclosed? Why are all these governments around the world being so successfully so successful at clamping down on all this material information that they have over at least 1947 and the Roswell incident, but likely long before that. And there's many scenarios that you can imagine for why they're actually working in our best interest. Like, if they know things that we would be horrified to find out, you know, like that this is an effort to steal human souls, and that they're already well underway with that, and that there's no way to stop them. I mean, would you as a government want your people to know that?
I have never seen any evidence of that in my work. I've taken hundreds of people through past life regression. Yeah, there's never anything like that's ever come up.
Maybe that's just a horror story that people come up with. I hope so.
Yeah. So what about this thing of the, I think they might call it the hitchhiker effect, where people have these UAP encounters and then all this other stuff happens around them, with psychic stuff and poltergeists and synchronicities. Do you think that's
that's further proof? That's further proof of the affinity and kinship between all these types of phenomena. You know, this writer back about 50 years ago, John Keel, he wrote a book called I think it was called Project Trojan Horse, and he put forward a concept of the super spectrum, which is similar to what I'm saying, is that there's all of these things can be grouped under a single umbrella of the concept of the spectrum of frequencies and density. for him, this was electromagnetic. I don't think that is. And I have a long section of the book where I try to prove that consciousness is not on the electromagnetic spectrum, but that it can interact with it. But so John Keel thought that it was an electromagnetic spectrum all the way up to from God down to the lowest, quote unquote, lowest creature, slugs and things. And that aliens and spirits and poltergeists and demons and elemental beings such as Sasquatch and other cryptids were all occupied, all naturally occupied, different kind of strata of this spectrum, this one giant, all-encompassing spectrum of energy. And it's appealing to be able to, categorize everything under one concept. You know, it sort of shrinks the problem space of all this sprawling, sometimes apparently divergent phenomena. And I'm drawn to that, and I have put forward a similar like theory. And so the idea is that like if you go to Skinwalker Ranch and you experience UAPs and you experience poltergeist effects and you experience seeing materializations of figures in the corner and you experience levitating pots and pans, which is poltergeist related, and you walk through cold spots that aren't related to weather, and you go back home 1,000 miles away, and various visitors to Skinwalker Ranch describe having the same things accompany them or re-manifest where they are. And I think, to me, it relates to the concept of resonance. You know, the old idea of an opera singer shattering a crystal glass.
Yeah,
that's if you can, and it is a true thing. It's not just a myth. I've seen it. and it's when you get your voice reaches the same frequency as the natural frequency of the glass. Every object, every instance of matter has its own natural frequency that it sort of rests at. And if the voice matches that frequency, then the two objects, the voice and the glass, are in resonance, it's called. And when that happens, the source adds energy to the target, and that added energy is what causes the glass to shatter. And I think that when people experience one species of paranormal event, it resonates with them, and they absorb and hold on to this resonance somehow, so that when they go back home, they're a different person from what they were before, and they now contain somehow within them a newly elevated resonance, which allows for endemic conscious agents who would be normally invisible and unknown to materialize and manifest wherever these people go. So that's the hitchhiker effect. It seems to hitchhike with them. But in fact, I think it's just that it crops up separately in the new place. It doesn't actually travel with them, although who knows. I think that it's just that the person's spirit, person's consciousness, becomes newly conditioned, newly equipped with a higher range of frequency than it had before. And this allows it then to resonate with whatever conscious agents were already at the house, but just had no vibrational relationship with the person before.
Well, it's been great talking to you. We've just about run out of time.
Oh, got started.
We've been talking about your book, UAPs and the Afterlife, New Disclosures Support Centuries of Psychic and Spiritual Research. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yeah, they can. There's a paperback version and a Kindle version. Kindle's only $3.99, so if you're interested, I would recommend saving your money and buying the Kindle version. Also, the Kindle has color photographs that come out much better than the print version. So I don't know why I'm undercutting my sales by, dissuading you from buying the paperback, but that's the way it is right now. So
yeah,
and at the back of the book is my website, and I can tell you right now it's the nearnessofyou.net. And on there is my email address. If anyone wants to write me, so you can strike up a conversation. It'd be great. I love it.
Great. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome, Simon. Thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
And that was an interview with Christopher Noel about his book, UAPs and the Afterlife, How New Disclosures Support Centuries of Psychic and Spiritual Research. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of the episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife. There are over 300 episodes. On the Our Paranormal Afterlife podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Our Paranormal Afterlife every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you are signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call that can be booked on my website. My Instagram is ourparanormalafterlife with an underscore between each word. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app. Make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. We blow up an atom bomb, a nuclear weapon, that it doesn't just affect us, that maybe it's affecting the dark matter in some way or the consciousness field.
I'm sure that it is. I mean, consciousness can affect ordinary matter in all sorts of ways.